Yes.
We were right from the beginning because, well, not right from the beginning. Most of our places that we danced were little fiddle festivals around North Carolina and Virginia, and bluegrass festivals. And then, but then the minute we started working at folk festivals, which I guess it was 75, maybe 74, maybe 75 was the first year we did the Philadelphia Folk Festival. So we came in contact with folk festival concept, you know, outreach and teaching. And so we wanted to get good at it right from the beginning of that, of being involved with folk festivals. And that whole approach really affected us. It made us think right from then into present of the idea of really sharing it with people, not just preserving it or performing it, but making sure to really share it. And we were real big on it back then, like spreading it. And we we used to pride ourselves on being able to, and still do, break it down for anybody and get anybody, you know, going just at least a little bit with their feet. We were always into that part of it.
What do you mean breaking it down?
Just breaking the steps down enough so people could grab hold of them and helping them, you know, drill or practice one or two simple little things so that the next time they heard a fiddle tune, they really could get their feet going, you know? Well, of course, we're always big on individual expression, too. That's the one way the Greengrass Cloggers were sort of parted from the rest of clogging. More contemporary clogging started to go in the direction of more regimented precision. And we were real big on individual expression and keeping a little bit of that wildness in there. And we got that from the old timers that we danced with. Because in the early days of the Greengrass Cloggers, 71 they started. And we'd go to, you know, just little festivals. Or, what's the one in North Carolina? You know, not Union Grove, but the other one. No. You know, the real festival, not Union Grove, but his brothers. Fiddler's Grove. And they had some, that was where we first encountered competitions, but that's where we first encountered Willard Watson. And he was a big champion of ours. And we were already kind of weird. We weren't like the other clogging teams. And right from the beginning, we were so impressed with Willard's freestyle, freeform. And his steps weren't as fancy and they weren't as showy, but they were much more percussive. And we were just real into that. So I guess from the beginning, we were real into individual expression and sharing it with everybody.
Speaking of sharing, can you tell me the names of all the people who were in the cloggers?
When we came in 77? I bet I could. Uh-oh. Let's see. The guys were Brian DeMarcus, Rodney Sutton, Earl White, Doug Baker, and then there were more guys, but they were on the home team. But that was the road team guys. Let's see if I got that. Brian, Rodney, Earl, Doug. And the women were Beverly Cotton, Karen Philbeck, Cherie Shepherd, Eileen Sutton. That was about it.
Sharon Leahy was later.
Sharon was later. Sharon actually replaced me in the Greengrass Cloggers, I think. No, well, not literally me. Let's see. Sharon was 1980, I think.
Well, tell me some scathing Augusta story.
Oh, my goodness. There's a bunch of them.
Whole repertoire.
There is a bunch of them. But I think one of the biggest things in our whole development has been Augusta, and especially the late night partying, especially the jams. I mean, a lot happens in the classroom, a lot happens with teaching people, and that's one of the highest experience I have is teaching here at Augusta and giving to people, and having the honor of being a teacher. And every year I try to rise to it more and more, and that's been a precious thing to all of us. But I think even more precious has been the spontaneous, you know, the jamming, the partying, the coming together of so many different musicians and dancers. I mean, you know this. It's just such an incredible energy. So the Ice House has been a big one in my life. Let's see. I can't think of a specific story right now. I could think of staying up late night, and we in the first years we prided ourselves on not sleeping at all. It was like our big, you were a wimp if you went to bed at all. So we taught all day long and partied all night long, and we got sort of in an altered state, I think. But the Ice House continues to be an inspiration in that way. You know, just all the different people who've come through there and all the different music that you, it's like a big thing in my mind. In fact,
it's a wonder it doesn't just levitate.
Well, I thought it almost was going to last Friday night, the last Friday night of Dance Week. I thought it was just going to lift right off that hillside and just. I remember, and now a lot of people wouldn't know this, but the Ice House is one of the first places that I started singing out in public. It was right here at Augusta. As Gary Wright started coming down here with me, he came and tuned pianos and. Well, that wasn't even so long ago. That was like in 85. And that was one of the first places that I sang out in public was the second floor of the Ice House. And one night we were in there at the piano, we were doing blues, and Howard Levy, who I didn't know yet, came in and played the harmonica right in my face. And made me a better singer just instantly. What I also have really fond memories of are the old time dance parties here that the Fiddle Puppets have been doing for years as a part of our instruction, because we figure, you know, we teach all day long and teach, and it's just like Freddie to come up here and do this to me, isn't it? It's just lacquer. So we have these old time dance parties and we figure, you know, we teach and teach and teach all day long, and then we started realizing that people were missing part of the tradition. Because if you break clogging down, you put it all down in their feet, then people get stiff and it's not a real experience. So we tried to balance that by having an old-time dance party every day where we do no teaching or breaking down or explaining, and we ask people to, we're trying to simulate the parties that taught us, really taught us. I mean, we always had steps broken down for us, but we really feel that what taught us was partying all night to, and dancing with Willard Watson and Robert Dotson, these old flatfooters that were heroes of ours, Hansel Aldridge from Charlotte, North Carolina, and dancing to great fiddlers, and we try to simulate that. And I've had really, really great memories of that old-time dance party. That year that we brought Robert Dotson up here from Sugar Grove. Are you here? Lord, he brought his sister and his wife and his cousin drove him up here. And they danced all day, every day, just every minute they were ready to dance. So that's a big memory for me, is the year that we brought them up here and the old-time dance parties. And we were afraid that students wouldn't get it. They might, and some of them at first really were a little unhappy with, they wanted instruction. They wanted to be taught flat-footing. And we were kind of like, you have to catch it. We, you know, just go with us on this. And eventually everyone, we got pretty happy. Where we just hung out and, you know, Robert danced every dance with everyone and started to learn it in a more traditional way. And that's a big one for me. Because I've taught people all day long and I'll see them come up to the old-time dance party and really start dancing. So that's a big memory for me. And just the incredible coming together of people here.
So your teaching technique has been, it sounds like it's been discovering a balance between this intuitive learning that goes on and then the specific.
Well, it's really been a big challenge for us because on the other hand, I'll teach technique, like real specific dance technique of clogging. and get real into just exactly how to do it, which is really beneficial for some people. But we've all, all along we've been looking for the way to give a more authentic traditional experience. I mean, clogging hasn't really been in a classroom for very long at all. And we actually started to see it affect the style. You know, learning in the classroom is different from really partying with it, which is what it came from, you know. So we wanted both. To us, you can look at it both ways. It's very serious, you know, beautiful dance form with a real specific aesthetic and all its own little nuances, just like any other dance form. I mean, that's been part of the fiddle puppet's work in a big way, is to get it to have that kind of respect and for people to be aware of that. But on the other hand, it is just, clogging is just spontaneous, individual response to fiddle music. So we've tried to have that balance, teach them both. And some people need real specific training in the feet, and other people get it just by looking into the eyes of someone really doing it, which is how I think most of us got it, was just being on the floorboards all night long. So we're trying to do both in our teaching.
I think your contribution to Augusta has been absolutely fantastic.
Well, I can't tell you what it's done for my life to be a teacher here. I almost can't speak of it. Every year I have tried to get better. Every year when the fiddle puppets do a performance here, we almost can't breathe, you know. We go out there, I mean, we're ready to die because it's like performing for your parents or something, you know. And I mean, we want to do so good, so bad. And I mean, I've tried to explain this to Margo. I don't know if she understands what it means to have a place every year that gives you an outlet and gives you that kind of continuity. Because, you know, in the folk scene, especially for a clogging team, you don't really have that so much. I mean, we would, in the golden age of the big clogging explosion in the folk scene, there would be some festivals that hired us back a few years in a row. This is when we were Green Grass Cloggers. But then, you know, we taught real good workshops, and then they'd get a local team, and there wasn't really a whole lot of support in patches over the years from the folk scene because, you know, of money and, you know, things like that. So in some ways, it's always been a real struggle for us to be a reality. And Augusta has always given us, you know, this place to go and get better and a place to exist. And then when I started teaching in 81, the response I got, I mean, I'd always taught in the Green Grass Cloggers and I'd always taught clogging, you know, at local classes. But it's hard for me to describe what it's meant to my life to be a good teacher here. I mean, I know for a fact that I wouldn't be, you know, anywhere near the person I am if it weren't for all the time that I have given to really wanting to add to someone else's life and really do a good job at that, whether it's performing on stage or like one year I did a remedial, it was a mini class, couples dancing, and it was for people who had never done a lick of it. And there was a local Elkins couple came, and they'd been married for over 50 years and they'd never waltzed with each other. And I can't tell you what it meant to me to teach that couple how to waltz, you know? And the joy that they got out of just, you know, it took them 4 days. So now I'm going to start crying, but I am, especially with you sitting here, Freda. But it's been like a home to us. I know everyone says that, but it's been major importance to us that it's been a place continually to get better. Like, what are we going to do this year at Augusta? It's always been that way for me as a director. I want to get better. I want to branch out a little bit more. I want our teaching program to be a little better. And it means the world to us.
Well, I think you all made Augusta what it is.
I think we all have.
My name is Freda Epstein.
No, your name is Michael Klein. My name is Freda Epstein. You are Michael Klein. Let's get that straight, Michael. Do you know who you are yet? Do we know what time it is?
Tell me a little bit about your first experience with Elkins, why you came here.
Well, I came here in December of 79 to audition to join Trapezoid.
My God.
I know. Isn't that amazing? So, and in December of 79, I packed up, and by the new year, actually it was March of 1980, I finally arrived. I came here cold turkey from Cambridge to Cow Patties. It was quite, as you know, Mr. Michael, quite a transition, getting used to being a city girl, and all of a sudden, here I am in West Virginia? Get out of here.
Not only West Virginia, but Montrose.
Montrose, West Virginia. 10 miles outside of the heart of town. I kept on having these fantasies that every time I would drive into town, I'd turn a corner and there would be Harvard Square, but it never quite happened that way. It took me a good 2 years, I think, before I had my first garden that I finally figured out what living in this town was all about. And then I had something a little bit more in common with the people that lived here. And then I really finally started to click and get into the community in West Virginia, especially the people in Elkins here. This place has changed my life. To me, it's like life before Trapezoid, life before Elkins, and life is what it is now, is totally a result of everything that happened to me in this town right here. I mean, I came of age in Elkins. It's like my formative years, my growing up years, and it's an amazing experience to finally get to come back. I moved out of here in 85, and since that time I've been studying and learning to become a teacher of the Alexander Technique and doing a bunch of other teaching, and coming back teaching these past 2 years is like I have finally arrived. I'm the person that I am, and it's like it's a incredibly powerful, important, meaningful thing to me, specifically to come back here. Because I was telling you all last night with Ruth Rogers that in some ways I think of Elkins as being more home to me than where I grew up in Boston, which is where I'm originally from. Because things just had so much of a greater lasting impact that I can't even begin to tell you all the stuff that went on. Playing music with you and Lorraine and Ralph. And all those times that we did concerts together here and did stuff together at Elkins, at Augusta. Ask me some more interesting questions and I'll have something more interesting to say.
That's a real good story. Sometimes I wonder, I hear people speculate about what it is about Elkins itself or this particular place that... Is this the kind of thing that could have happened anywhere else, or is there something about, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I don't think it... I mean, I couldn't say that it couldn't happen anywhere else. It would be a completely different entity if it happened anywhere else. I think what... one thing that's been occurring to me in this whole revival of appreciating the 20th anniversary of Augusta is that I haven't heard too much spoken about the importance of the townspeople themselves, the community here, because Augusta would not be Augusta if it were not for the people that were living here at the time, all the folks out in Parsons, the Wieners and the Kingsburys, and I mean, those are my particular friends, but we're the people that came to the dances every week and created a music scene that was going on here, and there was a scene that I didn't even know about before I got here, when Eric Schoenberg was living in town, and you know, there's a lot of people that I didn't get the opportunity to meet when I was here, but the fact that there were so many people who loved the music and loved the culture and loved each other and had a reason to get together on a regular basis to make music and to dance together, and that, in my perspective, that's what really got my involvement with Augusta happening, and that's how I see Augusta, is that the community was really giving a lot of energy to this place and really supporting it and coming out for it. And then Augusta got its feet on the ground and got off the ground and really started running and now is standing on its own. I don't know if the community is as much a part of it these days as it used to be. But
I think that's a good reflection about what happened. What are your earliest memories of Augusta itself?
My earliest memories...
Were you involved in teaching early on?
No, I didn't teach. I was more hired as a musician for Dance Week, so I played for a lot of dances in my first years here. And I started coming to Augusta back in 1980, and I think in the 12 years, I think maybe I've missed 2 years at Augusta not having something to do with it. Gosh, my earliest memories are mostly just of being in absolute, total, utter awe. I couldn't believe that this was going on here. I mean, I, I can't separate Elkins and Augusta. To me, they're totally intertwined, and even in my sentences, I'm substituting Augusta for Elkins because it's the same thing to me. When I moved down here, I played old time music, and I didn't really know what old time music was because I was a New Englander. I was a Boston kid, you know, and I came down here. And all of a sudden, I was thrown in with all these people who like really did the music and really knew the music. And then I was meeting all these people who I'd been listening to albums of for years and hearing about, like the Greengrass Cloggers and Kathy Fink. And all of a sudden, whoa, here I am, a part of the scene. And I was just like a little kid with my eyes wide open, and hopefully drool wasn't running too far down the side of my mouth. But that's kind of how I felt.
It was
kind of like, what am I doing here? And I was just soaking it in and just trying to keep my head on my shoulders and not go crazy with all the wonderful stuff that was going on here.
But you did go crazy.
It's true, I did go crazy.
I saw her go crazy.
Yeah, and I'm kind of glad I did.
Yeah, I did.
I wouldn't want to be too terribly sane about this whole thing. No way.
Can you say my name is Kathy Fink?
My name is Kathy Fink.
Tell us what your own Augusta story. Where did it start?
Well, I had lived in Winnipeg, Manitoba, up in Canada for 6 years, doing a duet with a guy named Duck Donald, great bluegrass musician. And I moved to the Washington area in September of 1979 and hooked up with a West Virginia wild man named Pat Shields, who had a little band called the Hooker Holler Symphony. And I was the bluegrass banjo player. We did play a lot of the prime pizza parlors of West Virginia. And about a month before the Augusta Festival in 1980, Pat said to me, well, I'm going to call up at Augusta and see if I can get us free tickets in exchange for doing something. I don't know what we'll do, but I don't really care. So he made some kind of arrangement. We got down here and did a little kids concert inside the YMCA in a hot, dingy, sweaty little room, and crashed 10 to a room at the Taggart Hotel the first night, and the next night I crashed in with my buddy Connie Regan, who was sharing a room with Issei Barnwell from Sweet Honey and the Rock, and I slept on the floor somewhere in that room, and had a bunch of friends who were here, luckily, already from my festival experiences up in Canada. The Red Clay Ramblers were here that year playing the festival, and a bunch of other people, so we partied our guts out. And the next 2 years, I kept calling Augusta. I was told that Paul Reisler was in charge, so I kept calling Paul, and I said, Paul, why don't you hire me to teach at Augusta? And he said, well, I don't know what you do. Then he'd say, you have to talk to Margo about that. So I'd call Margo. She'd say, well, you have to talk to Paul about that. And I'd call Paul. I was getting a hint, believe me. It took me a while, but I was getting a hint. But then I ran into Michael Klein at the Highlander Center, maybe around 81 or 82. It was Highlander's 50th anniversary, and I know we played a lot of music. And I said, well, Michael, what's it going to take for me to get on staff over there at Augusta? He said, I don't know, but I'll see what I can do. So that next year, which must have been around either 81 or 82, I came on staff first. I was there for 3 weeks, and the first week I taught guitar to 10 students for 8 hours a day. The second week I had 5 of the same students as the first week and 5 new students on guitar. The third week was the ultimate challenge because it was actually the beginning of Old Time Week. We had 27 students on guitar, banjo, and fiddle, and Margo had the idea that I could teach them all. Well, about midway through the week before, I was realizing exactly what challenge lay ahead, and I convinced Margo that a few assistants would make it a better week for everybody. So I convinced her to bring to Augusta for the first time Craig Johnson, who was a housemate of mine in Washington, and also Marcy Markser, who was ex-member of the Bosom Buddies string band from Michigan, and at that time was on the road with the Robin Flower Band. So they came in for my third week at Augusta, which was also vocal week of that year. John McCutcheon, Holly Neer, Michael Klein, a lot of great teachers. And so, you know, during the day we were all teaching, and at night we were just blowing the tubes out of every place that air could come in the ice house. And it was a really wild,
burning our guts out.
Wild year. And I had great students. It really was the first old time week. It just wasn't called that, but we put together some bands and we had a lot of great students that year. And I've been at Augusta every year since. I've taught guitar here, I've taught banjo here. And someplace around 5 or 6 years ago, Michael Klein and I co-directed Vocal Week for a couple of years until his jobs and locations and priorities had to change around. And so now I've been coordinating Vocal Week since then. And sometimes come to Old Time Week anyway just to be a bum and see who I can play music with and what I can learn. And I wouldn't miss it for anything.
How's your own teaching philosophy or technique or vision or whatever developed as a result of your work here?
Well, I look at that from two perspectives. One is my own personal individual teaching style, and the second is how to direct a week at Augusta and make it really happen. In my own personal teaching style, I've always taught a lot. And the thing about Augusta and the fact that one year I might be teaching harmony and another year I might be teaching banjo and another year I might be teaching guitar, I'm really on my toes. And I always come as a teacher over-prepared with materials, and then I don't really care if I look at them or not. It depends on who's there. If the materials I brought are the right things to use, I pull them right out. If they're not, I mean, the first thing I do is I say, what did you all come here for? What do you want to learn? What do I know that I can teach you? How can you leave after a week and feel like you are taking something great home that you can continue to work with when you get there? Like our harmony classes, there's a lot of people who teach harmony by rote and say, here's my part, here's your part, here's the third part. What Marcy and I do together is try actually to teach people how, when they go home by themselves and they just want to get in a jam session, how they can find those harmonies by themselves. So that's part of the philosophy. The other thing is, in terms of directing a week at Augusta, the biggest part of my work happens long before I get here. Reading the evaluations, talking to people, talking to instructors, talking to students, getting a sense of what worked, what didn't work, what would make the week flow better, all that kind of stuff. And in particularly October through December, that's when I'm really cranking, setting up the staff, setting up the program, helping write the brochure materials, all that kind of stuff. So that when I get here, hopefully, most things are set up. And then, I think as the years have progressed with Vocal Week since the very early ones that I'm aware of, there's been a gradual kind of change, too, in that I see the staff members of Vocal Week as the people who are the inspiring factors. They light the flame, but the students are the candle. And they burn it. The idea being that the instructors be inspiration, but the actual energy of the week be carried by the students, not by the instructors. Not to say that they're not putting tremendous energy into their classes and stuff, but we've been fortunate enough to have great instructors who see that the more students do, the more they leave with. So it's not very instructor central. The jam sessions are not instructor central. It's certainly not very coordinator central. I think I succeeded in being almost invisible this year and still having the week happen. And to me, that's what I want. You know, I mean, I want to be available to people if they need help and if they have a problem or if they just want to tell me that they liked it. But I don't want to be seen as this couldn't happen without her, or as, you know, all the fun starts there. And I don't want my instructors to be seen like that either. And I think that more than any other year, this year, that was an amazing thing. You know, I think the classes were intense, and I think they were successful. and I think people are taking home a tremendous amount. And at the same time, we have a bunch of people who do this. Some of them do it for a living and some of them don't, but their egos are in a place where they know why they're here. And that really thrills me.
I really agree with you. I really think you've done a great job at that.
It's sort of a synergy almost, isn't it, with all these different things going on at the same time. Do you think that enhances, suppose you took any one of these things and taught it?